He was an outstanding Marine, but was he also an insurrectionist? From SDPB, today is Thursday, October 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, the story of January 6th and how the military is still grappling with the idea of extremism within active duty ranks. We will preview a new investigation into the fate of Sergeant Joshua Abate. Then we get to know more 2024 South Dakota Hall of Fame inductees. Gay Kingman is a respected elder, educator, and policymaker. We'll also talk about her history in defining the tribal gaming industry. Plus, business leader Jim Entenmann joins the show. We'll talk about the evolution of motorcycle culture from the 70s to today and the impact of J&L Harley-Davidson. We're broadcasting from the SDPB Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. Years after the attacks on the U.S. Capitol building on January 6, 2021, the U.S. military is still grappling with questions of extremism in their ranks. A new audio documentary investigates the complex case of Sergeant Joshua Abate. He's an active-duty U.S. Marine, and during a polygraph exam for a special intelligence clearance, Abate admitted that he had entered the Capitol building just minutes after the doors were breached. Surveillance footage from the day shows him chanting "Stop the Steal" and placing a red MAGA hat on a statue. But Abate was otherwise known as an exemplary Marine. So, is Joshua Abate an insurrectionist? Or is he, as many fellow Marines testified, basically a good guy? A Good Guy is the name of the two-part investigation, and it's available now in Embedded. That's a podcast by NPR. I spoke with NPR Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman and producer Lauren Hodges.
He is married with a baby. He is from Western Virginia, about an hour from D.C. He is an evangelical Christian. His wife's grandfather baptized him in the Rappahannock River, and he's a Trump supporter and had been doing really well in the Marines. He was made sergeant early, and he got this really coveted internship, or he was selected for it, with the NSA, which he told us was so prestigious that you can basically ride it out until the end of your career. So he was doing pretty well. He was he had a good life going for him.
Yeah. And what does he do on that day?
He is invited by his two friends, also active duty Marines at Quantico, to go to the now infamous Stop the Steal rally. And he told us when we met him that traffic was so bad getting into the city that they missed it and decided to follow the crowd to the Capitol. He told us, you know, his version was that it was very calm, quiet, no rowdiness, no aggression, no violence. They just walked in. The police were fine with them being there. And that he was more of a bystander, just stood back and took pictures and didn't realize that he was doing anything wrong, according to him.
Yeah. At one point, he says he helped a woman of small stature put a MAGA hat on a statue, almost like he's helping an old lady across the street.
Well, so he says, yes. Yeah. So
right.
He says,
and he told us he couldn't remember what the statue was. And he just said, I just kind of walked around, didn't hear any yelling or screaming, didn't see any violence. But they dropped all the 5,000 hours of video from CCTV inside the Capitol.
The House GOP did that.
Right, after we talked to Josh. So Lauren was able to find a different story from what Josh told us, and that's a big part of the podcast.
Yeah. And the reason we were looking into it to begin with was because the story he told us just didn't make a lot of sense. Like Tom said, we were both up there that day. We had a very different experience. It was violent. It was rowdy. It was a historic event. And him to say, I didn't see much going on up there, just didn't track.
Yeah, that's worth looking into. So you have the tape. I mean, we can hear you on that day. We can hear you trying to get out of the crowd crush, Lauren. We can hear Tom's reporting from that day. So we have this audio picture in our head. Now, I want to go back to this moment when Josh first has to start talking about this. And it's something I've been through, a lot of people in the military have been through, which is a polygraph for a security clearance. He's trying to get this job. they ask you in these things all these really bizarre questions about, you know, whether you've ever lied, and they just are trying to figure out your character. And then they always ask you these super easy things, which is, have you ever tried to overthrow the U.S. government? And it's almost laughable, right? Because you're just like, no. You would think. It's just that's the moment where you smile and you go, well, no, this is an easy one. No, I've never had to try to overthrow the U.S. government.
And this course, guy. That's not what happened with John. Right?
Yeah. What is his answer to that question, Tom? What does he have to say?
Well, he said, it depends. And the poor polygrapher just got wide-eyed. You can imagine that poor guy. I would love to meet him and his reaction. I'm sure that was the first time he ever heard anybody say it depends.
It depends.
But then what happens after that is even more fascinating.
What happens next?
Well, I don't want to give away too much, but it's going to surprise a lot of people what happens after that.
Yeah. You're having this experience. He's going to go home and really delete the pictures he took that day as soon as he figures out that maybe, you know, he might be in a little bit of trouble. And he says to you in the interview, I knew this was going to reflect poorly on the Marine Corps, so I got rid of the photos. This national narrative in the press, in Congress, in all of our minds is going to play out. Now this is what, like 3 or 4 years ago that this happened, and this story starts changing. Lauren, this is a big part of what you're trying to watch as a journalist. How common is it for you to come upon a story that really starts evolving in this one with so much misinformation, so much scrutiny and attention? What were you noticing in your reporting?
Yeah, this one was unique for sure. One thing that immediately sticks out in my mind is about 8 or 9 months after January 6th, Tom and I went back to the Capitol grounds for this event called the Justice for J6 rally. And it was all of these people who were there in theory to support those who had been arrested for their participation in the insurrection. And we would approach these people and they would start telling us what the media is telling you is not true about that day. They had these really uniform talking points. It wasn't Trump supporters. It was Black Lives Matter. It was CIA. It was Antifa. And then we would say, well, then who are you here to support? And you could literally see like in their eyes, like, wait, yeah, what's going on here? And so this was a change that slowly started to take place in the media, in conservative media too, where they tried at first, I saw, to say those were not Trump supporters. Those were people pretending to be Trump supporters. But then as the FBI investigation took hold and the arrests began, there was no denying who was there. So then the changing narrative became, these are heroes, these are patriots, they didn't do anything wrong, they were just tourists. Like you could literally track it like with your finger where the story started to go.
And of course you hear Donald Trump say they are patriots and he plans on commuting some of their sentences, says they were treated horribly, and if they're innocent, I will commute their sentence. So it's still very much a part of the political landscape.
Yeah. Lauren, there's a point where they're calling, we need fresh patriots up front. We need patriots at the door. So the call at the Capitol is for people who are self-identifying as patriots, and you're seeing them use military tactics.
Yeah. This was by the stairs, the main Capitol steps on the east side, where kind of facing the Library of Congress, and there was a huge crowd pushing on the doors. But I think it was a little harder because the steps went straight down. So they kept trying to pull people who were kind of standing back, were a little bit bystander-ish, to the front to help them push. So this was one of these, you know, really complex parts of telling the story of January 6th, is this attempt to divide between the people, like they didn't punch cops, they didn't, you know, actually break any windows or something. Those are separate. During the day, there wasn't a lot of separation. Yeah. The power was in the numbers and the power was in the eagerness to participate and be part of this event. So trying to separate these two people, who's an extremist, who's not an extremist, got really complicated really fast.
Yeah. This idea of, does the military have an extremism problem? Does the Marine Corps have an extremism problem? How do you identify it? What are you going to do about it? That is fascinating to me. Is this something you've been covering a lot in your work, Tom?
Yeah, I've been asking about this for really many years, and more so after January 6th, you know. And if you look at the numbers, a third of the 200 were Marines, veterans, or active duty. So we keep asking, do you guys have a problem? And they say, we don't think we do. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin says it's, you know, very small numbers. We talked to the Marine Commandant. He kind of agrees, you know, very small numbers. But the problem is they really don't know because they're not collecting data. Finally, this year, all the services have put out guidelines. And part of that calls for defining what extremism is. And it's all your actions. But it also tells the services to start collecting data so we can all send the data up to the Pentagon and really, for the first time, get a sense of, do we have a problem or do we not have a problem? Right now, they don't know. So they'll start collecting data like they do for sexual harassment, sexual assault. They're finally going to start to do it. And we're going to keep an eye on that.
What do you hope people are talking about when they're done listening to this?
Well, I think one of the biggest conversation pieces is probably going to be the title, A Good Guy. I know it raised a lot of questions from people here at NPR when we were putting it together. Like, what does that mean? And is it ironic? Is it meant to exonerate Josh? What does it mean? And I think this is going to be one of these, and here comes the phrase again, it depends moments for a lot of listeners. And I'm really curious how people see the title and what meaning they take from it. There are going to be people who think, yeah, Josh seems like a really good guy who was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I understand him. I get him. I see some of myself in him, which is we heard a few times. Or are they going to be like, you've got to be kidding me. Like, this guy, you know, is trying to pull the wool over people's eyes because he knows he messed up and he's trying this charm offensive.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I'm really curious to see how that conversation goes once this is out.
You can listen to NPR's two-part embedded series now, wherever you get your podcasts. It's called A Good Guy. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. There are new faces in the South Dakota Hall of Fame and legendary South Dakotans indeed. We spoke with two of the newest inductees recently. Arlene Gay Kingman was inducted for her contributions in the field of education. Even after she shifted to public policy, steadied the National Congress of American Indians, helped define the gaming industry in Indian country, and founded the formidable Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association, she is still, at her core, at the front of the classroom. She joined us from SDPB's Black Hills Surgical Hospital studio in Rapid City. You were at the point in your life where there are many honors and many people want to look back on the work that you have done and say thank you and say this is work that should be honored and remembered. Take us back a little bit to when you started in education. Tell us a little bit about wanting to find your way in a classroom with students and really educating the public.
Well, I always wanted to help people or be an educator. And my goal was working with people, not so much, you know, like with machines or computers. But so I knew I wanted to work with people and went to Northern State. And that's where I got my degree in education. And, of course, Northern State University and was well-trained. And then I had a role model. Her name was Evelyn Bergen. She worked there at in Aberdeen. But she was an American Indian woman who had done so much in her life. Mm. And she became the first principal at Pine Ridge. And so when I graduated, she recruited me, and I went to teach at Pine Ridge, my first teaching job. Yeah. And working in a classroom is rewarding, and then it also has, you know, it challenges you as well, the teacher. And because you have a diversity of students, and some have great needs, some have needs outside the classroom, every student is different, and you have to tend to each student's need. And so as an educator, you know, you learn a lot, and because you're with a student, and you also have to think about them outside the classroom. Yeah. you know, like home conditions, or if they come to school hungry, or, you know, things like that that mean something to learning. And so being a teacher isn't just in the classroom teaching, you know, reading, writing, and arithmetic. So you have to think of the whole child.
Yeah, that can be a big responsibility. And also, that's where the love is too, right?
Yes, yes.
When did you get to the point where you thought, I could be at the front of a classroom? Were there teachers that made you feel like you could go into education, or did you have to find your pathway, you know, on your own?
Well, I guess I found my pathway on my own. However, with Mrs. Bergen, one of my role models, you know, as a principal, you know, she was always there to advise, there's a esprit de corps among teachers. You know, when you're at a school, you, of course, meet and discuss certain students and certain needs. And so among ourselves, you know, the teachers, too, help each other out. So there was, you know, no one special person except for Mrs. Bergen, I guess.
Yeah, Mrs. Bergen is, we all need a Mrs. Bergen in our lives, right? tell me how you shifted into policy, and how did you end up in Washington, D.C. doing that work?
Well, it's quite a story. I'd gone from teaching into being the college president, and was working at the college level, and this was at Eagle Butte at the community college there. And at the same time, we have a national organization called the National Congress of American Indians, which is nationwide, and it works with all of the tribes nationwide on needs and legislation and, you know, how to improve things with the government and, you know, budgets and all of that. And so I had been nominated as a secretary, so I had been the recording secretary nationwide for the National Congress. The National Congress had run into some financial trouble and was in need of, you know, really some fixing and some help. And the board realized this. So at the time, the chairman from Cheyenne River was Wayne Ducheneau, and he got elected to the board as president of the National Congress. So I had been out of the room working, and when I came in, the board and, of course, the new president sat me down and they told me, you are to go home and you're to go and resign your job. The vice president of the college will take over. You're to take the next flight out to Washington, D.C., and you're going to go in and fix the National Congress, the financial affairs, dealing with IRS, and, you know, put it right. So I thought, well, you know, this is a very serious situation, and I think I can do it. So I did. I resigned, and I took the next flight to Washington, D.C., and then certain tribes, like the Quinault tribe in Washington State, gave me sent me their finance director to help. Tribe in Wisconsin did the same. They sent me the finance director to help with you know, with the books and get ready for an audit and all of these things. And then I knew of an auditor by the name of Francis Killer, who I called, and so he came to D.C. He and his wife, who helped him, and we started on the financials, and with everyone's help, we were able to deal with IRS because they hadn't paid unemployment tax, and so we fixed it. We worked out an agreement with IRS, and we put the financials in good order, and then the auditor put a great new system in place. So, you know, it wouldn't happen again. And so anyway, we were able to do that. And thanks to the help of, you know, the tribes. And so today, the National Congress is a very powerful organization in Washington, D.C. and it continues to, you know, advocate for all of the tribes nationwide.
So I'm thinking, it sounds so stressful to me, but what you just said about you wanting to be with people, it also sounds like a community of, you know, a small group of people coming together with the support of a larger group of people saying, well, we're just going to take this one problem at a time. So you're really working with people, even though you're working with paperwork and data and numbers and and policy and problems. It was the people you remember about that time, right?
And it's constant education, though, because, you know, we have to educate, you know, ourselves on the financials and everything. And then the National Congress educates people on who tribes are and what they do. And so it's, my husband always said, we're in the business of educating and dispelling ignorance, and we'll never be out of a job.
Wouldn't it be nice if you could work your way out of the job? But you have said that the work of sovereignty is ongoing to...
Yes.
Yeah. And the passion that you have for that. Is it always educating new people that's starting from scratch? I mean, I think of sometimes when I lead a book group, and they'll say, oh, I never knew this history happened. And I'll think, well, we just read a different book last year where you learned this history, and now we're reading this book and you're saying it's new. And sometimes I get twisted around in my mind with saying, like, no, it's not really new. You're not starting from level one. But you also have people who are starting from level one. So I guess my broad question is, is everybody just in that classroom coming at it with different, different levels, like an elementary school classroom or a high school classroom too?
Exactly. That's right. And so you have to start with where they are. And even, you know, like with sovereignty, we here in South Dakota, you know, all of our tribes are treaty tribes. They signed treaties with the United States government, so it's government-to-government relationship. Mm-hmm. And so, but we ourselves have to educate a lot of our own people and our, you know, our young people coming up and what that means, because the tribes operate full-service governments. You know, they have a Department of Transportation, a Department of law and order, you know, and all of these, just like a state does or just like a city would have. And so it's constant education, I think. Mm-hmm. And if you don't know, you know somebody that does know and can help educate.
Yeah. Tell me about one of the other key moments in your professional history with the National Indian Gaming Association. What do you think people need to know about that time and the impact that it has today?
Definitely people need to know, because that was a particular time when Congress had passed a law for tribes to allow them to set up gaming establishments. Mm-hmm. And immediately, there were skeptics, and one, of course, was past President Donald Trump, and a lot of it had to do with, you know, people didn't want tribes to game. I mean, there was competition and all of this, but the law had been passed, and so here again, the tribes asked myself and my husband and Rick Hill to establish an office in Washington, D.C., so we could, here again, educate and help tribes set up their gaming establishments. We eventually, after a year or so, were able to purchase a building in right on Capitol Hill, but we had to start educating. Some of the law said that a state had to sign a compact with the tribe to do gaming, and they came to mutual agreement on what those guidelines were and everything. But some of the states refused. They didn't want tribes to game for various reasons. So it was our work then that we had to go into every state and work with them, work with the state legislature, and get them together with the tribes on setting up the compacts, which would be the agreement between the state and the tribe. Mm. And so it was a sometimes contentious time, but overall it worked out. And now, you know, it's a multi-billion dollar industry.
Yeah.
You have some great, great casinos and that tribes operate, full service operation. And here in the Dakotas, you know, we don't have the market that, say, Minneapolis, you know, tribes close to Minneapolis would have,
mm-hmm.
or tribes near. In California, there's a big market. So our gaming establishments in South Dakota, although successful, you know, there's not the great market. So, but the thing about Indian gaming is that the proceeds go to the government to do what they can for the people, mm-hmm. such as setting up schools, setting up elderly villages, you know, to benefit the tribe.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in the case of other gaming establishment, it goes to the owner and for his pocket and his own proceed.
And this was an important part of how you were able to reframe the argument, was where the money was going. Was that all education too? Tell me
yes.
a little bit about how you came upon this idea that, hey, here's the piece that people don't know. They don't get this.
Yes, that was a very big piece, because when we had a hearing on the House Resources Committee, the former president came in to testify because they had introduced legislation to deny Indian tribes to game.
Yeah.
And we were able to use that, and we had the children from a school in Minnesota that had been set up entirely from proceeds from the Indian gaming. And it created this school on the reservation. And so children had school to go to. And
mm-hmm.
So these children came in and they sat in that front row. And we were able to say, this is an example. It's government, the tribal government proceeds doing beneficial to the tribe.
Yeah.
And anyway, the chairman of the committee brought it before the board, the committee, and it failed, the legislation to deny Indian gaming.
Yeah.
And that legislation failed. And so we have the Indian Gaming Regulatory Act, which is in effect today.
Yeah. What have you learned about, you mentioned, you know, things being contentious. What have you learned about how to navigate contentious times or times of conflict with groups of people? Like when you go into a new situation and, you know, a young person comes along and they're like, this is so stressful, what's your advice?
Well, the only thing is to get together and talk it out. I mean, and here again, educate, because a lot of people didn't know that, you know, in our case, it was governmental gaming, and proceeds go to help the people. And so after we talked it out, you know, they realized it would be beneficial. In other cases, you know, you just got to come together and talk it out.
The Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association, tell us a little bit about the origins of that.
The Bureau of Indian Affairs is broken into 12 regions, and every region is different. The Great Plains region is North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. After my husband and I moved back to South Dakota after working for the National Indian Gaming Association, the tribes approached us and asked us to start a Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association. There's 16 tribes in the states of North Dakota, South Dakota, and Nebraska. So the tribes could come together and unify around certain things that needed to be done, like certain legislation, or if tribes in their state had a certain issue, you know, we could work on solving it. it's always good to have that unity to work on problems and help each other. Because every day we deal with Congress or legislation. Every day we deal with budgets, because the budgets come from Congress. You know, right now we're writing that appropriations with Congress going on right now. So we've got to know about it and work it, because those appropriations then come out to the states and the tribes. So there's so much work, and that we need to come together to see what would best help our people in the states, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's why they asked us to start the Great Plains Tribal Chairman's Association, so we would have that unity and able to work on solutions or even praise those things that happen that are real good, you know.
Right. That's 2024 South Dakota Hall of Fame inductee Arlene Gay Kingman. What an honor. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. If you're involved in the motorcycle scene in South Dakota in any way, you have probably heard of Jim Entenmann, or maybe even rode with him. As co-founder of J&L Harley-Davidson in Sioux Falls, he has supported the growth and expansion of the industry since 1975. Entenmann is an inductee into the 2024 South Dakota Hall of Fame for his excellence in leadership and entrepreneurial spirit. He joined us in SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls.
Well, you know, it was very exciting when I heard, and I was very honored, and I was very, in a way, taken back by it. You know, the fact that I did get nominated and then inducted, and I thought it was really, really cool. It helps to validate, in a way, in my mind, it validated everything I tried to accomplish throughout my business career, into my private life and into what I do in retirement. But here you got to remember, I was 73 years old, and I was just notified I was being inducted in the Hall of Fame, and I've been retired for 3 or 4 years now, and it's just like, wow, what did I do to deserve this? You know, I pulled up the roster, and I looked at the roster of the people that came before me, and I listened to some of the interviews of those people, you know, and some of the testimonials for what they'd accomplished in their lives, and it's an amazing group of people. And quite honestly, I think you and I just talked a little bit briefly about it, how much we love South Dakota. And I think what it really does, it really targets and it recognizes the everyday person in the state of South Dakota. It doesn't necessarily, it's not based on the money you have or the education you did or how much you donate. It's all about community. Mm-hmm. And every person in every category from throughout the state, if you read through and if you listen to what they have to say, they really believe in a higher calling. It isn't about what they're going to accomplish on their own, but it's what that they can accomplish because of the position they're in, because of the hard work that they've done, and it's what they can accomplish and what they have to give the people in our state, in our local citizens, all of those throughout the state of South Dakota. So it was really, really exciting. I was shocked, by the way, like I said. I was like, hey, what's this old man getting inducted for? But I have to read this to you because I really think that this is important, because I do want to share what it really has to say about all of us that have been inducted. And it's about celebrating 782 dream chasers. Since 1974, the South Dakota Hall of Fame has sought to honor, recognize, and distribute the stories of everyday people who have found the strength to chase their dreams, no matter the obstacles they faced along the way. And I am honored to be part of that class of 2024. And I think and like I said, if you go through and you review some of the people that have been inducted into the Hall of Fame, the people that were inducted in the class of 24, and read their stories and listen to their stories, it's really pretty impressive. We're really fortunate in the state of South Dakota.
Yeah. Being in business is about more than making money.
Yeah.
It's about more than your profit and loss statement. Did you learn that as a younger man? Did that come to you after you had been in a business a while? Like, take me back to some of the beginning when you're learning how to be in business and what that means. When does it become something that is more than, are we going to keep the lights on one more week?
Well, you know, that keeping the lights on is really an important thing. And honestly, when I did start in the business, you know, it's a family business. My dad and my brother Lonnie and myself started it. Therefore, Jim and Lonnie, that's J&L Harley-Davidson. And I'm happy to say that My sons have taken over the operation. They bought us out, and hopefully our legacy will continue with what we've been able to accomplish. But, you know, those first years back in 1975 when I started selling motorcycles, it was a garage operation. It was myself and my brother. We were in a small store out on Burnside, and we did everything from selling the bikes to repairing them to doing all that stuff. And it was tough. My wife had to get a job, mainly because we needed insurance, and we couldn't afford to buy it at the time. Mm-hmm. And keeping the lights on was a big deal. We worked 7 days a week. We sometimes worked, you know, 10, 12, 15 hours a day, depending upon the time of season it was. We did everything that we did. For the first 20 years we were in business, I would have to say that it was all about the business. It was trying to keep those doors open, turn the lights on every morning, turn them off at night, taking care of the employees. As we got a little bit bigger, it was taking care of our employees so that we wanted them to be able to have a pretty decent living, because we wanted them to be able to ride motorcycles and send their kids to school and those kinds of things. So a lot of concern about the employees that we had. You know, for the first 20 years, we were in the same store on Burnside. And then all of a sudden in the 1990s, the baby boomers came to life. The business just jumped by leaps and bounds. We built a new store in 1994. The first year we moved into that new store, our sales went up 35%. And what we learned back in those days is that you really can't manage to growth like that. We outgrew that facility in a period of 4 short years. You know, we built a 15,000 square foot store. We thought we'd died and gone to heaven. We thought we were going to be there forever because we had more room than we needed out in the West Sioux area of town. And like I said, we quickly outgrew that in 4 years. And then we bought our current location that we have up on 60th Street North. We built a 32,000 square foot building, a multi-floor building up there. We have warehouses. We have a state training center for motorcycle safety classes. You know, we have a campus now of almost 20 acres of land up there. So we grew a lot in those time periods. We also have stores in Watertown, South Dakota, in Fargo, North Dakota. So business has been good to us, and we grew. But what I did learn is that making a profit in business is a good thing. It's what drives everything. But if you do that, you do have a responsibility to give back to your community in any way you can, whether it's with your financial ability, whether it's with volunteering, whether it might be running for political office. Whatever you can do, you know that you can help your community and continue to grow your business and take care of those that work for you.
Yeah. Let's go back to Burnside.
Yeah.
Because there's a whole lot of history that's spooling out here. In the 70s,
yeah.
Vietnam, yeah. Hell's Angels, Hunter S. Thompson, biker culture is one thing. I mean, somebody had to come and look at you, go, you're in business doing what? Somebody was suspicious of you, I'm guessing. And then, you know, 90s, now veterans are coming back from the Gulf War, and those Vietnam veterans are saying, you know, you will not come home like we came home. And then you move into Iraq and Afghanistan. But all this, and I'm not conflating what you're doing with veterans, but I'm thinking of motorcycle culture and how it changes in those cultural moments in time. Now, overlay Sturgis and South Dakota and the motorcycle culture that we have created here in the state, mm-hmm. that you have created here in this state, and how that infiltrates out into everything. And my mind is just kind of blown right now.
Yeah.
You've seen it change a lot, but you've made it change a lot. How are you responding to some of those changes? What were you seeing in motorcycle culture and Harley culture that maybe other people weren't seeing, that you saw the future of?
Yeah, boy. It's a question covering an awful lot of time. We just
made this really big. But I'm thinking about, I mean, I just want to pick your brain on that, because what a cultural shift.
Yeah. It's a huge cultural shift. You know, back in the, you know, quite honestly, if you look at the history of Harley Davidson, if you look back into the 1910s, the 1920s, 1930s, you know, Harley Davidson, back in 1903 when Harley Davidson was founded, we were competing with the autos. In 1903, Harley Davidson was founded. Henry Ford had his first production line that came off, and the Wright brothers flew the first airplane. Think about that.
Yeah.
So for the first 10 years at Harley Davidson, we were competing with the auto business for the primary mode of transportation. There were no roads, no paved roads. Everything was just ruts. If you can imagine in this part of the country riding on a motorcycle in the wintertime when you've got, you know, 3 feet of snow on the ground or more, and the wind's blowing at 30 miles an hour, cars won that race, needless to say, okay? But what Harley-Davidson did do, they specialized in, like, utility vehicles. They specialized in police motorcycles.
Yeah.
The first in World War One, the first doughboy into Germany rode in on a Harley-Davidson motorcycle. Harley produced a lot of motorcycles during both the World Wars that were used exclusively for military service during that time period. And Harley-Davidson took great pride in producing a quality motorcycle and committing to the defense of our United States. Mm-hmm. When our troops came back and when our veterans came back from World War II, you know, if you stop and think about it, it wasn't like today where you have your cell phones and you got television and you've got radio out there and all kinds of media you got access to, right? If you think these guys were over in Europe, you know, or over in the Asian Pacific area, they were over there for 2, 3, 4 years. Lucky if they got a letter from home, you know, mm-hmm. being away from home that long. They come home, you know, the adrenaline's always flowing because they're in combat or whatever's going on. So they're all hyped up, right? They come home and now you got to get a house, you got to go to school, you got to get an education, you start raising a family. That's how the motorcycle culture, or when the motorcycle culture really began, was right after World War II, because these people were coming home, our veterans were coming home, and life was dull compared to what it was during the war, okay? I don't mean that negatively. It's just a fact of life. You have all these young guys, you know, in their teens and their 20s, you know.
The purpose and the meaning
exactly.
is missing. Yeah.
And for excitement, they went out in the deserts down in California and Arizona, and they were riding motorcycles. They loved the freedom of the air blowing through their hair, you know, those things when they're on the motorcycle. You're by yourself, and you're responsible for just yourself. You're not worrying about anybody else. But that was really the beginning of the culture, you know. Like everybody else, you get together with people of like minds, and that's somehow some of the clubs and stuff formed. Some had positive, you know, some were negative, right? Yeah. But that's really how it got going. And quite honestly, it even continued up through Vietnam. And you saw people coming home, and Harley-Davidson back in the 60s was having a lot of problems. There was a company that was faltering. It almost went out of business back in the 60s. And it came back in the 70s and the 80s. And there again, it's because the baby boomers were coming home. They were people that were very serious. They worked hard at their lives. They raised their families. They worked hard in business. But then they wanted to start enjoying life. And that's in the 1980s and 1990s, Harley-Davidson just exploded. Mm-hmm. And it was about the camaraderie of riding a motorcycle, whether you were an attorney, whether you were a judge, whether you were a millionaire, you know, or if you were just a guy working in your gas station at home. It was all about the motorcycle and about the experiences that they had riding those bikes. And it's about that freedom of riding with a group of people with like minds again, and about being out on the road. You know, it's like they always say, you know, if you go on a ride and it rains all the time, you said, hey, I've got the T-shirt to prove I did it, right? So it's really, really neat. And we were really lucky to be in a position that we could take advantage of that. Yeah. From being a store that just started, you know, with only two of us, my brother and myself, you know, and my dad, but then starting to grow. At one point in time, I had over 195 employees. And with the facilities and stuff we have now, the quality of the product is so much better than what it used to be. And back in the 70s, it was challenging because you did have to fight this thing about you're in the motorcycle business. And, of course, riding a Harley-Davidson motorcycle was not really socially accepted back in the
60s. People have forgotten that a little bit. That's why I bring it up, because my dad rode back then, and I rode with him, and there was this sense that everybody was looking at you.
And they were, and we loved it. It made you feel good,
exactly,
by the way.
I think that was what he was in it for.
You know what it was, and you said you rode with your dad, and that's what it was for us, and that's what I think made things a little different, because for us it was about family. I remember going on some runs with a bunch of our guys. And we were riding, you know, some of us had our wives and girlfriends with us. There may have been 20 or 30 motorcycles, you know, riding two up. But behind us, we had a half a dozen cars that had our kids, had our families, and all of our tents and everything we needed for the weekend. So it was really a family experience. And that's the way I always promoted the business. And that's how I think that we were able to overcome some of those challenges. And then also being receptive to the needs of your customers.
Yeah.
As the business became more popular, our customers had more demands on the products that they wanted, the quality of the products, the service they wanted, all of those kinds of things in business that I think most of us try to provide, right? We're in the entertainment business. That's what we were in.
Yeah.
You know, we weren't competing with other motorcycle dealers. We were competing with golf courses, with campers, with boats and motors and those kinds of things.
Yeah.
And we just had to provide that exceptional experience. And I think we did do a good job. And as a result of that, by the way, you also have that responsibility, like I said earlier, of giving back to your community. And I'm very fortunate that I was able to be involved with those kinds of things, too.
Giving back to your community through public service, through philanthropy, but also through the visionary of what we would build next in the city of Sioux Falls in the state of South Dakota. Help us understand how you look at building a community and being part of conversations about what should be here that creates a place where you want to live and where you want your grandchildren to live.
You know, initially, I got involved with tourism in the city and also throughout the state. I served on the governor's tourism advisory board for a number of years. I was also in the Sioux Falls CVB at the time. And I was president of that organization for a couple of years, too. And I always looked at what kind of services we wanted to grow our business. But at the same time, I felt that there was a responsibility of what can we do to help our community. And you stop and think about it. You brought up Sturgis, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sturgis is the largest, most recognized motorcycle rally in the world. I can be traveling anywhere, overseas, anywhere. And if I'm wearing a Harley-Davidson T-shirt, everybody says, it says South Dakota on it. They say, oh, do you live in Sturgis, you know? So how do we capitalize on that? And I think that we've done a very good job of that if you think about it. In a small population state like what we have, and we can bring in 500,000 people a year to travel through our state, to go out to Sturgis, to spend their money out there. And what's unique about those experiences is that we're in the middle of nowhere in South Dakota, right? We're in the middle of the country. People have to plan to travel like that. It's not like you're living in New York City or down in Florida or in California where you've got access to millions of people within an hour or 2 hours or 3 hours. So things are different here. People actually have to plan. And that's why it's always hard to find hotels that time of year, right? And it's really a lot of fun. So I think that was important. But as your community begins to grow, you also have other things that you want. You need to provide opportunities for people that are moving into our communities to enjoy life and improve their quality of life, so to speak, you know. And when I served on the city council in the city of Sioux Falls, I was involved with the Build It Now committee to build the Denny Sanford Premier Center.
Mm-hmm. Not too far from Burnside.
We're not too far from Burnside, but in the center of our city for the most part, right?
Yeah.
And it's been a huge success, and it's given us those opportunities now when people are looking at moving into Sioux Falls, whether it's the entertainment that we offer through the Denny Sanford Premier Center, with all the colleges now and Division I sports and being able to provide those things, mm-hmm. with the Washington Pavilion that we have downtown, the quality of life, the development of our downtown area, and all the restaurants and all the opportunities for entertainment. Look at the football opportunities for our youth, the soccer opportunities, all the softball fields we have, the park system that Sioux Falls has boasted on and continue to develop. We've got some great quality of life things here in South Dakota, and those are important, I believe, for all of our businesses if we're going to be able to grow. We need to help have our sights set on those, and what can we do to help that stuff and help facilitate the growth of those things?
What have we gotten wrong but correctable?
What did we got wrong? One of the things we have wrong is the weather we live in a lot of times in the winter time,
right? I haven't figured how to ride those bikes in the snow yet.
It's kind of tough. It's kind of tough.
We'll work on that one next, right?
No, we just have to keep working at it. We need to embrace people, and we need to encourage people throughout our communities to be involved.
That is 2024 South Dakota Hall of Fame inductee Jim Entenmann. That's our show for today. We hope that it served you. For Ellen Kester and Ari Youngeman and all of us at SDPB, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.